We're in Mark chapter 9-ish. I do want to give us some time, though, to kind of reflect on what we talked about at the end of class. Because I want to make sure we're on the same page and why I'm saying what I'm saying. And what's really cool is that this passage today, I think, will help us interpret the end of chapter 8 at the beginning of chapter 9 as well. But before we get to the text today, I want to see if anybody has any thoughts or reflections at the end of last class period. In particular, we're talking about Jesus laying out the political program of his kingdom. We're very clearly, after you hear this rebuke by Peter that Jesus then has to rebuke him for, Jesus calls a crowd together. He says, let me make sure you get all this straight. I'm not playing your honor games in that way. I don't care if I'm shaming my disciple or making myself look foolish. The way the world works is not the way my kingdom works. What the world values is not what I value. What the world fights for is not what I will fight for. How the world fights is not how I will fight. We are a different kingdom. And if everything looks upside down to you, it's not because the kingdom is wrong, it's because you're not seeing clearly. Spiritually, you're partially blind. And that's how all this section connects. And then, the kind of the issue, exegetically or hermeneutically, in verse 38, if any was ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. And the temptation is to see the second coming. But I suggested yesterday, along with chapter 9, verse 1, that he's actually talking about the establishment of the kingdom at his first coming, especially at the crucifixion and resurrection, based off of what Old Testament text? Daniel 7, 13 through 14. And that interpretation about Daniel 7 is not unique to me. That's actually something that N.T. Wright talks about with Daniel 7, and he hammers on over and over and over, is that the coming, Daniel 7, the way we interpret it, is not the way that the Jews would have interpreted it either. Matter of fact, the one like a son of man, N.T. Wright does make the right point, I think the correct point, in my estimation, that they would not have looked at the one like a son of man as an individual. They would have seen the nation of Israel as the one like the Son of Man. Because the nation of Israel was the Son. It was God's Son. It was God's agent on earth. So they would have seen Daniel 7 differently. But the New Testament seemed, and Jesus' ministry seems to reinterpret that whole image. Number one, the one like the Son of Man is not a people. It's a person that leads to a people. Leads to the establishment of a kingdom. And number two, he's not coming from heaven to earth, although I don't know that the Jews would have seen it that way anyway. But he's coming from earth into heaven with the clouds. And that's what I think is the backdrop of these two verses. Therefore, Schweitzer and I don't agree on this. He does think that Jesus messed up, prophesied his second coming, thought it was going to happen. But as a historian, and I'm going against a lot of big shot historical Jesus scholars on this statement, as a historian, I think that's naive. Personally, not a theologian, as a historian, I'm going, really? This guy is so worried about protecting the Christian community, and he's going to give a false prophecy in the mouth of his king, of his leader, really? I think there's a little bit more at stake for Mark to be historically integral. Oh, if he said a false prophecy, I've got to record it. Yeah, right. I don't buy that. Historically, I would say, no, I think we're not seeing this in the right perspective. Otherwise, I don't know why he would have put it in there. Therefore, I look for a second option. You see why I'm going where I'm going? People will accuse me of going there because I'm trying to protect some nebulous doctrine of inerrancy, and that's just not the truth. It's not what I'm trying to protect. I'm trying to ask the right questions of the text. Does that make sense? So any questions, concerns, thoughts, reflections? I want to give you time to digest that. Maybe it's not shocking to you at all. Maybe you're saying this is something I've known all along. But for me, it was actually a pretty shocking study. John?
We talked yesterday about him calling the crowd to him, mm-hmm. about the honor shame.
Probably, possibly, yeah.
Possibly, okay. And then he says, you know, some ridiculous statement that would have probably brought shame more than honor.
Yeah.
But in the end, it doesn't say anything whether they, like, laughed or whether they...
Yeah, we don't even get the result, and ultimately the result's not the issue. Yeah. And he, even in this, redefines honor, which is kind of ironic. He starts the honor game and then redefines what honor even is. You want to save your life? Lose it. That's not the way the honor game goes. Yeah, I don't care. I've called you over to make a fool of myself or to reorient everywhere that you're even pointing toward. Does that make sense? You were going to say?
Is it possible, it seems like he's bringing it in, like, here's an honor shame situation, and then it's almost like unresolved at the end. So,
yeah, it's somewhat unresolved, yeah.
As far as, like, that context.
Yeah, we don't get the crowd reaction, that's for sure, at least. And what's even more shameful is even the fact of what he's just even said before and after, and that's the Son of Man's going to die. I mean, the people would be going, that doesn't make any sense. And he's like, I'm not asking if it makes sense. That's why I found it quite ironic yesterday that, you know, Dave Stone used the 1 Corinthians 1:18 passage, the exact one we read in class. I was like, no way. Like, him and I didn't even talk. I don't even, you know. But I think that's something that God's trying to at least hammer home to me. Is of course this is foolish. And I love the text that he quotes in 1 Corinthians 18, where he says, I will destroy the intelligence of the intelligent. I love that. Because, man, we think we are so smart. And we think that whether we're talking politically or theologically, we've got it all figured out. And if you just follow our plan, you know, I mean, just look at the political, oh my goodness, the political debates that are going on in our country right now are just about as cumbersome and worrisome, you know, annoying as they normally are. But just right now, they're just annoying me even more. You know, oh no, if you follow my 999 plan, everything will be fine. Oh no, if you follow... So, man, you people just think you got it all figured out. And guess what? You'll get into office and you'll do exactly what Obama did. Is you'll just basically fold under the pressure and just do whatever system everybody tells you to do. But everybody's got it all figured out. Totally figured out. No, you don't. We're a mess politically, economically. No one knows which way's up. Everyone's guessing. And no one thinks, I can tell you this though, no one thinks Jesus' political or economic way of living is the right way to go. No one thinks that. You can't sustain a country that way. Can't sustain an empire that way. Just can't. Which makes it all the more weird. But hey, never mind. I won't say any snide comments. I'm a little tired. Sometimes snide comments come out and I won't do that today. I'm fighting. Other stuff. Yeah, Scott.
I was really interested by, like, because I always assumed this was about, like, the end times. Mm-hmm. About stuff we were standing there with seeing. So I was really interested in the thing that that's talking about, crucifixion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because even the word some is important there. You even almost in a sense, if our interpretation is accurate, the word some is important because it's in a sense also predicting the betrayal. Well, and not to mention the fact that he does have a larger group of disciples there, so it doesn't necessarily just have to be the 12. But if we were just talking about the 12, even that statement is true just for the 12. Only some of you will see this actually come to fruition. Not all of you. But yeah, since it's a larger group of disciples, technically, who knows how many will see and don't see. But yeah, it actually fits the evidence best. And that's the thing I get frustrated. Whenever you look for options that fit the evidence the best, people think that you're trying to protect something theological and not just trying to be... No, I'm just trying to figure out what's the best solution. And everything's an option for me. And that makes some people uncomfortable too. It's so funny. Whenever I'm giving my interpretation, a lot of times people that are more liberal or are fighting for something liberal get upset with me. But whenever I look at my methodology, people that are conservative get upset with me. Because literally everything's an option for me. It is an option for me that maybe Jesus did make a false prophecy. That's an option. But it doesn't seem to fit the data the best. Like, I'm okay with that being an option. It doesn't scare me. But it's not the best option. That's the problem. The problem isn't, it doesn't make the most sense. Now I'm asking from a historian's perspective. Now, theologically, that could present a problem for me, but until my history challenges my theology, I don't even need to really even mess with that. And the bottom line is, from a historical perspective, it doesn't make the most sense, so for me, it's not the likely option. See, there's a difference between honest or historically having integrity in our historical inquiry. And there's a difference in just looking for something to undercut something or looking for something just to support something. I want to know the truth, whatever the truth may be. And I think the truth here is makes much more sense that he's pulling from an Old Testament passage than for me to make a modernist precision mark on whether or not this actually come true. It's like we were talking about New Testament ministry the other day where people are saying, well, technically Jesus said in the temple there wouldn't be one stone left on another, and so that prophecy technically didn't come true. I said, no, that's actually false. To say one stone will not be laid on another doesn't mean if there's actually two stones still on each other that the prophecy didn't come true. The temple, you can't sacrifice anymore. There is no altar. There is no Holy of Holies. You're going to think that they thought his prophecy didn't come true? That's psychotic. The Dome of the Rock is right where we need to be doing altar sacrifices if we're Jews. Yeah, his prophecy came true. It's not about the stones. It's about the cultic acts that you do with inside those stones. So I don't buy this junk that, well, technically the temple never completely fell. It's yet to be completely fallen. You're a moron. Tell that to a Jew. Oh, the temple didn't really fall. we haven't been able to do sacrifices for almost 2,000 years. I don't think it's standing, because ultimately the walls mean nothing to me. What means something to me is it actually fulfilling the act it was meant to do? And the answer is no. Therefore, it is not standing. Does that make sense? You've got to read this from the right lens. Otherwise, everything looks blurry. Other stuff? Yeah?
I don't know. It's kind of cool, but like, a lot of times when you start trying to tell God what happens, it doesn't work out very well.
Yeah.
A lot of times better if I just get up and just kind of follow what God said.
Yeah, not just most of the time. You're right, all the time. And I'm interpreting your figurative speech. So you're exactly right. And it is a simple thing, but it's not simple. I mean, that even goes back to even what we were talking about just a minute ago. A lot of times, most of the time, our frustration when things aren't going our way is that it means we're out of control. We want to be in control all the time. And part of the way of being in control is understanding everything. Oh, if everything's totally logical, then there's in some sense I have control over it. If it makes total sense to me, then in some sense I have control over it. But I agree with exactly what you're saying. Is God saying, no, not everything is going to make sense because you don't have the control. I do. Well, I mean, and that's really what we've been tracing for the past two chapters, isn't it? Isn't that the issue in the clean and unclean issue? When Jesus says, we're not doing this anymore. And people say, I have a problem with that. Why? Because we don't believe who you are. He says, well, if you understood who I was, it didn't matter if what I say makes sense. You'd obey it. And that's the same thing that happened in the Gentile situation with the disciples. Same thing that happened with the Pharisees asking for a sign from heaven. Same thing that happened in the Peter's confession whenever he rebukes Jesus. Same thing that's happening here. It doesn't matter if you understand. What matters is do you obey or do you trust the one? Do you really understand who he is? And if you do, you'll obey it. But most of the time, you're right. We want control. And so we'll try to do things our way. And when they fall, this is the thing that's annoying too. So whenever things start crumbling, we try to blame it on God. Oh, he's trying to punish me or teach me a lesson. Or you're a moron. And you could have prevented this if you'd have just done what he said to begin with. Because these were the natural consequences of you being a moron. You know what I mean? Why is it that God's punishing you every time? My word, it's so much easier to blame it on him because in some sense then we still keep control. If it was his fault, then it was out of my control and it's not my fault. Therefore, I'm still in control. I have a right to be in control of my life. No, you don't. Actually, it was your fault to begin with. So because what's happening, matter of fact, you don't even know what he's protecting you from actually falling into disarray. Man, we can blame God so easily whenever things are so clear they don't go our way. We have no idea how many things he's protected for us from actually going really bad. We don't even ask that question because it's not answerable. But boy, we think the other one's answerable. But ultimately, it's because we're seeking control. Yeah, and you're right. A lot of times we should just shut up and listen to what he's saying. Not because then we'll have the best life now. I actually saw somebody on Facebook, I think it was one of my former students, made a thing with Joel Osteen saying, you'll have your best life now, and it's on the picture of the Christians being mauled in the Colosseum by lions. Whoops. Yeah. If they only would have known their best life was now. Ultimately, though, yeah, you're right. We just don't trust God. And but trust, you have to understand, trust is directly related to identity. Directly related to identity. If you know who he is, trusting will be a lot easier. If you don't, it'll be pretty hard. You'll constantly be fighting him. Other stuff. This is good. We haven't had time to do this recently, and I wanted to give you guys some time to reflect and just digest what we've been going through. Anything else? Yeah, Skylar.
What? I know it's, you know, there's, you know, lose your life, and you'll find it, and, you know, kind of an invitation, you know, to come and die. But, like, what is that for the crowd? Like, what does that mean? Like, what do they do? Do they just, like, follow Jesus around and listen to his teaching, like, a ton? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, and notice the word that connects verse 35 and 34, the word for. Therefore, verse 35 is an extrapolation of verse 34. What it means is take up your cross. Politically, they know exactly what that means. Ultimately, it goes back to this issue that we were just talking about just a minute ago. What it means, whether or not they got this or not, whether or not they could clearly see or they were seeing things still upside down when he was talking or not, is something I can't answer, because I don't know how the crowds are responding to this in this moment. But I can tell you what lose your life means to them is that it's an extrapolation of take up your cross and come follow me. Join a failed revolution is what it's saying. Join a revolution that has already failed. Well, that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense if we're gauging the success of it by the standards of the world. No, it doesn't. But if we're gauging it by the standards of God's kingdom, it makes perfect sense. So ultimately, what I would say is that they would be connecting the whoever wants to save his life will lose it, whoever loses life will save it. They would see that as just as anomalous as pick up your cross and follow me. He connects it together. And ultimately, what are they trying to do in the honor game? They're trying to fight for their own life. They're trying to fight for their own dignity. They're trying to fight for their own... Jesus says, stop fighting and go hang on a tree. If we don't fight, then we're going to collapse in our own society. Maybe your society is the problem. Maybe you need a new society. Maybe you need a new lens. Maybe you need a whole new perspective. Maybe you need a new kingdom. Maybe you need a new king. And I'm offering all of that to you. And you may not see that. You may think it's foolishness. But ultimately, that's the only way you're going to find life at all. So I honestly think the way they would have interpreted it is with the same confusion as verse 34. Whoever wants to follow me must deny himself, take up his cross, then come after me. What? Oh, let me just compound the issue. For, let me explain that further. If you want to find your life, you got to lose it. So stop trying to find it and just lose it. That doesn't make any sense. Oh, let me just make it even worse. If anyone's a that's about as worse as it gets. You see the point. He doesn't. He actually increases the tension in verse 35, because they think, maybe we can spiritualize verse 34. Don't spiritualize it. Let it be what it is. I want you to come and join a failed revolution. We're literally falling after me. People will say, "Man, that looks like you're cursed by God." Yeah, it does. But I'm not. Yeah, man, cruciform living. Living life in the shape of the cross. Very simple. Very hard. All at the same time. It's actually, this bracelet came from a youth group that sat in on one of my deeper life classes. Because I talked to my Christian life class and I say, the whole phrase, "What would Jesus do?" is stupid. Because it's like hypothetical. We should be pursuing what would he do. We need to just be asking, what did he do? And then go do that. It's very simple. What did he do? Oh, go do that. And that's the whole point of this passage. We don't need to be guessing about what it means to take up our cross. We don't need to be guessing what it means about losing our life. We just need to read what Jesus did and not spiritualize it and just do it. We don't. We have every excuse in the book. Every excuse in the book. And a lot of times it's our society trying to justify itself by explaining away the words of Jesus. So you get a lot of people that'll accuse Christians that want to share everything in common as pursuing communism. Really? Sorry, the gospel's bigger than communism. It's bigger than capitalism. It's bigger than democracy. It's bigger than dictators. It's just bigger. I'm not pursuing that. Because I want to help give away all my things so everyone is without need. I'm a communist? Or I'm biblical? Have you read Acts 2? Have you read Acts 4? Have you seen Jesus' ministry? What did he do? We can explain away anything to justify what we're doing. It's kind of like whenever you get talk to people that are, you know, trying to justify their sexual impurity. Man, they'll come up with every linguistic thing in the book in order just to try to justify themselves being sexually immoral. I mean, just quit playing games. You're being a moron. And you're trying to justify your moronic behavior by twisting the words of Jesus or ignoring some of his clear statements. Stop it. What did he say? What did he do? Anything else before we transfigure ourselves? Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Backtracking a little bit.
That's fine. We can backtrack all you want.
In verse 33, it said, "You turned and looked at the disciples." In 34, "He then turned and called the crowd." Do you think there have been multiple people who had heard the confession of Peter?
It doesn't seem to be that way. Jesus and his disciples, and the reason why it doesn't seem that way is because if that is the truth, there'd be no reason to make a distinction of an expansion of the group. I mean, is it possible? Sure, it's possible. But whenever Jesus says, "Who do people say that I am?" it'd be somewhat shameful if right in the middle of it he shows that they said it wrong. I'm not saying that eventually they won't get it. But I see no indication of the text that it's not just Jesus and his disciples until verse 34. So it's possible. It's kind of like the Sermon on the Mount. It does seem at the end of the Sermon on the Mount to indicate multiple people heard the sermon, even though at the very beginning it seems to indicate it was only his disciples that came to him. It's possible, but I have no evidence really either way. And really what's in the text makes me say the probability is it was just his disciples that were asked that question, gave the answer, and once they started really screwing it up, Jesus called in all the crowds. I mean, it's possible. You see what I mean by that? I'm trying to be...
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, if they were actually in the proximity of his confession, then wouldn't that have set the tone even before just expanding the crowd of them being attended?
Possibly. Again, like, that is possible that they were standing around and overhearing. It's possible. Nevertheless, I don't understand why then the detail in verse 34 of him calling the crowds over to him is important. From a historical perspective, I would say, well, you don't even need that. All you need to do at the very beginning is just say, the crowds were near Jesus, and one of his disciples said, or something like that. But instead, he seems to be pretty specific. The disciples were there, and Jesus asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" And then he says, and then, verse 34, he called the crowds over to him and said. And so I don't understand why that detail is important if all the crowds are there anyway overhearing. Could they have? Sure. It's possible. But I don't think that's the best explanation for all the details. That'd be my response. Other stuff? All right. We are in Mark chapter 9, verse 2. And what's really actually cool about this, and the reason why we did do some of that reflection time, is because the conversation really hasn't stopped. And that's what you're going to be noticing. That's one of the things I love about tracing Mark on a day-to-day basis the way we are, is that sometimes people think that the review is superfluous. But what you're able to see is the continuity of the conversation that you miss whenever you splice it all up between chapters and verses. He's still talking about the same thing. And ultimately, what Jesus has said over the past 2.5 chapters is so astounding. It's so over the top that, frankly, there does need to be a sign from heaven to validate what he said. Because my word, he has just said that the clean and unclean issue is done. We don't need it anymore. He's just said everything that you thought the way the kingdom of the Jews was going to be established is different. It's going to include the death of the Messiah. It's going to include persecution on me and eventually you. It's going to include a lot of stuff that you're not cool with. And eventually they're going to be going, I don't care how many miracles you've done. I can't buy this. This is crazy. Maybe the miracles are going to your head and you're becoming, you know, psychotic as we speak. And then 9 verse 2 happens, what we refer to as the transfiguration. After 6 days, stop. Why is that important? You see, this is interesting. Whenever you're looking at numbers for Jews, it would be foolish to say every single time there's a number, there is some sort of symbolic thing behind it. It would be foolish to say that. But it would be naive to say the opposite. Do you hear my caution in that? It would be naive to say, oh, there's never really anything symbolic behind it. Especially after how we've seen numbers already functioning in the Gospel of Mark. He likes to use numbers to point us to a reality. What is the significance of 6? What?
Incomplete.
Why? Where do we get that? I don't know who said that, but why do we get that? Yes? Right, the 7th is the number of completion. Absolutely. And 6 is not 7. Now, it is possible that, you know, it's just that there were 6 days. It was just 6 days. It was a historical reality. And if you want to align yourself with that, I'm fine with that. Because it could have been. Nevertheless, in this moment, what's going to happen here in the Transfiguration was probably exactly what the Jews were thinking when the kingdom was going to be established. For the Messiah would appear. And then some Old Testament patriarchs would also appear. And then the presence of God would come. And then they would build tabernacles. And from there, they would launch out an attack, a war on the enemies. This is the moment they thought was going to happen when the Messiah appeared. And almost at the very beginning, the number 6, if it is symbolic, could be saying, this is a significant event, but this is not the event. This is not the event. This is something that's huge for the establishment of the kingdom. But this is not the moment that the kingdom is being established. Because in the verses that just preceded it, what was it describing as what was going to be establishing the kingdom? In the verses that we just been talking about, what was going to be the key moment of establishing the kingdom? Crucifixion, the resurrection, and the ascension, the coming on the clouds, right? So even though this event is significant, this is not the event. So it is possible that Mark, right off the bat, is trying to literally say, hey, it's significant, but it's not the complete establishment of the kingdom that's still forthcoming. There is also a theological way of seeing the symbolic referent of number 6. And that is, before Moses received the law on Sinai, he went through 6 days of preparation. That it was leading up to the event, but it was not the event itself. Is that making sense? So literally and theologically, I think there's much more behind these words 6 days than merely a historical counting of the number of days between the time period of the Great Confession and the Transfiguration. Now, am I saying there's no historical reference? No. Okay, you follow me? But what I'm saying is Jews usually always pointing to something bigger than what we are comfortable with. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him. Oh, what do we have here? Who's going with him? The inner three. Where else have the inner three gone with Jesus so far in the Gospel of Mark? Yes, to raise Jairus' daughter. Everyone's cleared out of the room and just the three. There will be one other place in the Gospel of Mark where the inner three are found. Where is that? Yes, Jesus praying in Gethsemane. The inner three. And I've talked about in here why I think those were the inner three. Yeah. I think that these were the ones that were probably the most foolish and needed the most help. And, you know, all I have to do is just kind of read their track records. You know, Peter rebuking Jesus just like, you know, 5-6 verses earlier. Whoops. Peter also be the one that denies Jesus. Then you have good old James and John who, in the next chapter, they'll ask for the key seats in the kingdom, one on the right and one on the left. And there are also the ones in Luke 9 who say, hey, Jesus, do you want us to call down fire on the Samaritans and wipe them out? That's the inner three, ladies and gentlemen. Meet them, greet them, and know that if God can transform them, you're good to go. Okay? Because ultimately, these will be some of the key leaders in our church. But they needed the most help. Although, somebody can make an argument that Judas needed help too, but you can only have three. Otherwise, it would be the inner four, and we just can't have that. You do have to wonder though what Andrew's thinking. You know what I mean? Hey man, we were all four called around the same time, and how come I'm not one of you? I don't know. Andrew might have been like my older brother, and he would have just been happy for his brother to be in that position because he knew what his brother needed. That's probably what I think is happening. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. Okay. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses who were talking with Jesus. Really quick, I think this is interesting. This is maybe one of the most significant events that occurred pre-crucifixion, pre-Easter. One of the most significant events. Because Jesus turns into a light bright, which is pointing to some theophanic moment. You know what I mean? And I think it's pretty fascinating, number one, that we have to remember who is behind the Gospel of Mark. Who's reflecting on this moment? One of the inner three. Peter's going, oh man, and then you're never going to guess what happened. I had one of my worst moments in verse 31, and then I had one of my worst moments in chapter 9, 2 and following. But man, even though that was one of my worst moments, it was one of the best. As a matter of fact, Peter will bring this up in one of his later epistles. In 2 Peter 1, 17 through 18, Peter says, "For we received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory saying, 'This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased.' We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain." See, Peter's going, man, I remember that time. Can't help himself. But what do you find very odd about Peter reflecting on this in his gospel, in his letters? What do you find odd? What? Why would anybody in the world bleach him? Is that what you said?
No.
Oh. Believe him?
Whiter than anyone in the world.
Yeah, that is kind of an odd statement. And we'll actually talk about that more in just a moment, because I think that actually is a hint later on. But what do you notice?
Why didn't Peter describe this later on?
Maybe what?
Why didn't he just later describe it in greater detail in his letters?
Yeah, maybe why didn't he describe it in later detail in his letters? You're on the right track, but there's even something I think that's even more anomalous. Yes?
Peter is the one who was acting so foolish. He's pointing it out.
Yeah, now that is something kind of weird. In a minute, we're going to see that Peter is the one that is the key fool back to back, but he's saying, let me just talk about this again. What else?
The fact that they actually have to see Jesus.
Yeah, this is the only time in any of the Gospels that Jesus' description is actually described. That's kind of strange. We have John the Baptist being described, right? He's wearing, you know, camel's hair. He's wearing, you know, all this stuff. But Jesus is never described except at the transfiguration. But there's something else that's weird. We have who is in a present? Who is in attendance? Peter, James, and John. James' writings. Do we have anything about the resurrection? Or about the transfiguration? Trick question, because James in here is not the James of our Bible book. That's James, the brother of Jesus, that wrote that book. So we don't have any writings of James. But we do have writings of John. And what do you notice that's strange when you start thinking about the writings of John?
He's missing like 90% of what Mark.
Yeah, he's only got an 8% overlap with the Gospels. And in that 8%, we don't find the transfiguration. That's weird. That Peter, man, he reflects on it in his gospel. He reflects on it in his epistles. John writes the gospel, three epistles, and Revelation. And we're saying that maybe he doesn't have it in his gospel. But I actually do think that he does reflect upon it in Revelation. I believe Revelation chapter 1, the way he describes Jesus, I believe that he saw the transfiguration twice. Let's read Revelation chapter 1. And we'll see what you think. And I'll pull out the parallels more clearly in a moment. Revelation 1, verse 12. John's on the island of Patmos, verse 9, by himself. Whenever verse 12 happens, "I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And among the lampstands was someone like a son of man." Huh. Interesting designation. based on what we've just talked about and based on what verse 9 will once again refer to Jesus in chapter 9 of Mark. One like a son of man, dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet and with a golden sash around his chest. His head and hair was white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he had 7 stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp double-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in all its brilliance. If you take the descriptions in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Mark, and you put them together, you see some interesting parallels between Revelation chapter 1 and the Transfiguration. Let me give some of them to you. Revelation 1:9, he is on the island of Patmos alone. And Mark 9:2 emphasizes they go up on the high mountain by themselves. There's an isolation factor to this theophanic moment. Revelation 1:13 describes the clothing glowing in glowing terms. In Mark 9:3, you also see his clothes became as white as the light. Glowing. Light bright effect. Revelation 1:13, description of Jesus like one like the Son of Man. Mark 9:9, description of Jesus as the Son of Man. Revelation 1:16, his face was like the sun shining in all its brilliance. Matthew 17:2 says, his face shone like the sun. Revelation 1:17, the reaction is that they fall down as he falls down to Jesus on the island of Patmos as though he is dead. And Matthew 17:6 says, when the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified, indicating as if they were dead. Their reaction is similar. We also see in Revelation 1:17, Jesus responds by touching John. He reaches out and touches him. Matthew 17:6, but Jesus came and touched them. Revelation 1:17, Jesus says, don't be afraid. Matthew 17:7, Jesus says, don't be afraid. You see the parallels? It's almost as if John sees the same thing twice. So I do believe he reflects on the Transfiguration. But I believe he reflects on it by describing what he experiences a second time. And he says, in both accounts, he says, this is Jesus. You want to know who Jesus is? This is Jesus. There is a key difference, though. In Mark 9:9, after the Transfiguration, it will say, Jesus will say, don't tell anyone until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. In Revelation 1:19, right after he sees that transfiguration moment, Jesus says, write down the message and tell everybody. What's the difference? John's second transfiguration is after the resurrection. Therefore, his job is to tell. Contra Mark 9:9. It's possible. Some people will say that's not possible, or that's not really what's happening. Yeah, you could say that, but I think it's possible. Verse 4, and there appeared before them Elijah and Moses who were talking with Jesus. What is significant about these two cats being on the scene? Say it again. Yeah. Initially, that's it. Yeah, you're bringing in chapter 6. And that's right. And chapter 8. Who do people say that I am? Elijah. Well, now they're going, well, there's Elijah. What do we do now? Yeah, that's interesting. What else is interesting? What's important about these two guys coming on the scene?
They're huge.
What?
They're huge.
They're huge. You mean size-wise, or?
The Old Testament, they're really important in framing about new things. The new covenant from Moses.
Huh? Yeah, absolutely. That's great. That's a great theological analysis of their hugeness. Yeah, Moses bringing in a brand new covenant through the establishment of the law, through the covenantal promise, through the Exodus itself. And Moses became synonymous with the law. Same thing with Elijah. Elijah was huge when it came to the prophetic voices. One of the earlier prophets that even Malachi 4:5, like you referenced, said that he will be an intricate part of the establishment of the kingdom. I will send Elijah before that great day. Absolutely. Matter of fact, Elijah became synonymous with just the prophets. So if you wanted to refer to the Old Testament, you could just say, yeah, we're talking about the law and the prophets. Jesus says this. Somebody comes and asks him, they say, what's the greatest commandment? He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Well, he first says, love the Lord your God, the Lord is one, quoting the great Shema. Then love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. He says, and love your neighbor as yourself. He says, and all the law and the prophets hang on this. He's referring to the Old Testament. in a sense, what you have here appearing in physical form is the Old Testament, the Law and the Prophets. Everything that the Old Testament was is wrapped up in these two figures. That's how huge they are. Because if you wanted to refer to the Old Testament, man, just talk about Moses and Elijah and you pretty much got it covered. And that is quite significant. What's what I think the implications are will happen at the rest of the Transfiguration. And we will delightfully get that tomorrow. Sound good? Love you guys. See you then.